here on WBAI Through the Ages, preserving a platform for future speakers, for future voices to come on the air right here in the center of the FM dial at 99.5 FM to come on to WBAI, to come on to this platform and share their views and engage with you. Please help support WBAI 212-209-2950 in honor of Samori and all the other voices you've heard here on WBAI and all the voices that you will hear, but you don't even know who you're going to hear, but you'll hear them if you tune in to 99.5 FM in the center of the FM dial, or if you listen online, as so many of our listeners do, at WBAI.org. Please come forward and support WBAI. Become a listener member of WBAI for $25 for the year.
Or episode of Middle East in Focus from KPFK Los Angeles. I'm Esti Chandler. This program is part of Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing a Nakba Day, May 15th, each year, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents. We are very happy to be part of this year's programming. As the renowned Israeli historian and author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Ilan Pape writes, the 1948 Israeli War of Independence involved one of the largest forced migrations in modern history. Between 1947 and 1949, over 400 Palestinian villages were deliberately destroyed. Civilians were massacred, and around a million men, women, and children were expelled from their homes at gunpoint. Yet, for almost six decades, the myth that the Palestinian population left of their own accord in the course of the war persisted, being pushed out by Israeli officials to the media, to their foreign counterparts, and it was taught widely as fact within Israeli and American Jewish communities alike. As Pape documents, from its very inception, a central plank in Israel's founding ideology was the forcible removal of the indigenous population. In recent decades, as Palestinian narratives have made their way to a broader public, increasingly horrified by the brutality of Israel's permanent military occupation and apartheid rule over Palestinians. With continued land confiscations, home demolitions, and the destruction of Palestinian neighborhoods and villages, it has become increasingly clear that the Nakba, or catastrophe in Arabic, has never ended for Palestinians. The mass destruction of the Gaza Strip over the last 7 months, where the majority of the people driven from their homes and lands in 1947 and 48, and again in 1967 fled or were pushed to, has ended all legitimate debate. Israel's current genocidal attack on Palestinians in Gaza is the still unfolding next chapter of the Nakba. I am so grateful to have a perfect guest today to educate us all. Dr. Ahlam Mutaseb is a professor of media studies and the graduate coordinator of the Department of Communication Studies at California State University, San Bernardino. She is the recipient of multiple academic awards in addition to the 2019 Rebuilding Alliance Storyteller Award. Her phenomenal documentary, 1948, Creation and Catastrophe, has been screened at over 20 film festivals and at universities and community organizations around the world. The film, co-produced and co-directed with Andy Trimlett, focuses on the year of 1948 and its catastrophic consequences for the Palestinian nation, and was born from her fieldwork in the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, and Palestine. 1948, Creation and Catastrophe won the Jerusalem International Film Festival's 2019 Special Jury Award for a feature documentary and remains on numerous short lists of documentary films about Palestine and for educating the public about the roots of the ongoing tragedy that has led to the genocide we are all witnessing today. It is always a great honor to speak with Dr. Ahlam Mutaseb.
Thank you very much for hosting me, Esti. It's an honor and pleasure to be with you all.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to have this conversation with. So if you don't mind diving right in, Ahlam, the roots of your fantastic documentary film, 1948, Creation and Catastrophe, is from the fieldwork that you did in Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, in Syria, and in Palestine. Can you talk about that work, when you did it, and how it eventually led to the film, of course, including the importance of telling the story of 1948 today?
Thank you for the question and for hosting me. And I would like to start by acknowledging that I'm joining you all from the unceded, colonized indigenous lands of the Komi'ai First Nation in San Diego. Yes, this project started with me, the idea, the conceptualization, when I was a grad student at the University of Memphis in Tennessee. At that time, I just had met my husband. At that time, we were not married. And I started getting up close to his family story, because he is a descendant of refugees. Two families, you know, his mother's family and his father's family were both forced out of their villages in a Nazareth area or Nazareth. And although I'm Palestinian and I was a grad student on a Fulbright scholarship at that time, I was an international student who just came out of Palestine. And I, you know, at that time I had lived most of my life in Palestine. I was not a refugee. So I, of course, I knew the history in general and all of that. And I had never had the chance to have this closeness to what it means to be a refugee. And also it's kind of like ramifications and consequences on one's life. For example, it was very important for him to live in the United States and get citizenship, because the Syrian travel document they had, which basically states that they are stateless, didn't allow him to go to the majority of countries in the world. And it was a miracle that he was able to actually come to the United States to study. So I started, you know, knowing what it means to be stateless in practical ways, you know, how does that look like in real life, right? And so just listening to his story and how he told the story of his father and mother, grandmother and grandfather, you know, his memories, you know, like absent memories, basically, of a place he calls home, but he had never been to that country, to that land, just made me think, something has to be done about that. So I started thinking, I have to study the power of story, storytelling, the oral history of refugees. How is his, you know, identification with a land he had never seen is so strong, is so powerful. It's the land he wants to end up living in when he can. Or at that time when he could, of course. And so I started, you know, thinking about study of the impact of intergenerational storytelling among Palestinian refugees on their sense and, you know, like mindfulness of collective identity away from home. And I was thinking also, like, how is also intergenerational trauma a factor in that identity formation? And I did a proposal when I was a grad student for my dissertation, but my advisor at that time, he said, this is a great study, but it's going to take you forever to finish. And you already got your first 10-year track job at Cal State San Bernardino. I'm still teaching. And he said, so you have to find something more manageable than this, and you can take it, you know, and run with it when you finish your dissertation. Because this was kind of like a long-term study. So I said, cool, you know, so I did something else. You know, I did a quantitative study about Arab Americans and their use of the internet at that time, talking 2003. And then, you know, in 2006, I was ready to hit the road with the study. So I got some grants from the school. And part of the study was, actually, I started thinking, and I was inspired by actually Ed Sweet in I was an active member in Jewish Voice for Peace. But at that time, my connection to him was that I was a volunteer with Alternate Focus, kind of like an independent TV station in San Diego where they did television productions for public TV in many, many cities around the United States. They used to actually mail the tapes the old-fashioned way. And Ed said, you know, make sure you document this on camera. Like, don't waste this important opportunity. So he gave me some basic training and helped me actually buy the equipment with the grants I got, like filming equipments. And at that time, you know, my goals were very limited. I said, I'm just going to do a small scale, short classroom video about what it means to be a refugee, living in a refugee camp. And my focus was Lebanon, actually, because the refugees there lived probably the worst, not now, of course, in comparison to Gaza, but at that time, the worst, you know, living conditions with all the restrictions by the Lebanese government on them. And, you know, taking a social justice perspective, you always think, what is the most marginalized group among the population I'm studying that I should focus on? And it was actually Lebanon. Anyway, I went in 2006, and I actually started in Syria because I went and visited my husband's family for the first time ever. And it was a challenge to even go to Syria. And I filmed for a week in Al Yarmouk refugee camp that doesn't exist anymore in Syria, which was actually the largest refugee camp in Syria and probably the largest Palestinian refugee camp in the world at that time. It had over 1 million people in it. And so I collected some data. Of course, you know, in 2013, it was totally destroyed by Al-Assad regime, basically. And the majority of residents were forced out. I think there are only like a few thousand left there. Anyway, I did some filming there, and then I moved to Lebanon, and I started working in Lebanon. I mainly worked at that time in Burj al-Barajna refugee camp in the capital, Beirut. But then Israel invaded and destroyed, you know, the airport. I actually left by a miracle, you know, by coincidence, because I wanted to go visit my family and then come back in Palestine and come back and continue my work. And I was, you know, interrupted until 2008. I could talk about the story of how I started working with Andy in a minute. But, you know, so that's the genesis of the scholarly aspect of the project. And it was kind of like a critical ethnography and in-depth interviews. This was my approach. But at the same time, the idea of the video came from this constant feeling that, okay, I have to switch from media critique and knowledge critique about my people, about us, you know, because it was very frustrating, to knowledge and media production. So that was also kind of a shift in the way I started looking at things. And since, you know, with information technology revolution at that time, I thought this is more doable than any other time. Although, you know, with lack of access.
Can I ask when the importance of telling the story of 1948 came to you and your focus was shifted there?
That was actually Andy. So I met Andy in 2007. So as I said, you know, in 2006, my work was interrupted and I honestly was devastated. And I said, okay, I'm going to come back later when the dust of war settles and it's possible for us to go back. And in 2008, I got, you know, grants again, you know, and I wanted to go back, take my camera and go back to the refugee camps and continue my work. And then Andy contacted me and I honestly don't remember how we learned about my project. Maybe we were talking, but anyway, he contacted me. So we met in 2007 and I was, you know, kind of like reading a script. He wanted to do a film in Lebanon about the 2006 Israeli invasion, actually. Then when he learned that I was going back, he said, okay, I have a proposal for you. So I want, you know, he convinced me to shift the focus to 1948 because he told me that as an American, average, you know, white American, actually, who has no connection to the conflict whatsoever, so-called conflict. Okay. And after doing his master's degree in Middle Eastern studies, he still could not actually understand the so-called conflict. Because most Americans think it's thousands of years old conflict between Muslims and Jews in particular, who hate each other for some reason, can't stand each other, and just like to kill each other. And, you know, the perception here in the United States, it's complicated, it's intractable, etc. And then Andy, after finishing his master's degree in Middle Eastern Studies, read a book, and I can't remember which book that was, but it focused on 1948, and the light bulb clicked, basically, in it. It's like, okay, now this is clear. So the systematic ethnic expulsion that happened in 1948 explains it all. There was no country called Israel. This is a new conflict. It's contemporary. It's not really hard to understand once you understand, you know, the events of 1948 and how, you know, basically the creation of the state of Israel came at the expense of another nation, the Palestinian nation that was basically expelled from their homeland. And that was the start of the genocide that still continue until today. So for him, it was to understand home demolitions, to understand colonies or settlements, if you want to call them, to understand the repression, the uprising, everything, you have to go back and understand that contemporary history. And actually, he sold me the idea. I thought it was a great idea. And then this is how we started working on the larger project, which is the film, you know, 1948 Creation and Catastrophe.
So I've watched the film several times. And for me, one of the most powerful parts of the film is your technique of interviewing people who lived through what Israel refers to as the War of Independence and Palestinians refer to as the Nakba. Can you talk about those people that you interviewed and the many viewpoints that they represent?
Yes, thank you for the question. So the approach initially, and my approach and Andy's approach after, you know, we agreed to start this documentary was I would go to Lebanon in 2008. This was actually August of 2008 and interview as many refugees, Palestinian refugees as possible that he would travel to Palestine. I think he traveled to Palestine in October or November of the same year and that he would interview Israelis, and if possible, also Palestinian refugees, because, you know, there are many Palestinian refugees still, you know, in refugee camps in the West Bank, in Gaza at that time. And also, you know, Palestinians who are internally displaced in Israel, the state of Israel. And the majority of the Palestinians I interviewed, they all wanted to talk, except for one person who refused to talk. Only one among all the interviews, and we have done over 100 interviews, and we only used 33 in the documentary. Just to give you the scale of our work, you know, we eventually had to cut the film several times from 2.5 hours to 2 hours, etc. So, of course, you know, we couldn't include anyone. But then the Israelis, of course, we sent Andy basically because I couldn't have access physically and, of course, mentally, you know, to get across those interviews. They wouldn't, you know, sit down with a Palestinian name who is visibly Muslim, you know, because I was the hijab, although I'm white passing, but I'm visibly Muslim and I have the name and also my Hebrew is very limited. Anyway, so that's like, they wouldn't sit with a Palestinian woman and tell her what they did to her basically ancestors, right? But also I couldn't cross an imaginary border that Israel created called the green light because they have the West Bank ID, which limits my movement. Although I have an American citizenship, by the way, but my American passport does nothing. You know, they have no respect actually for the American passport. The minute I cross the bridge, I'm not even allowed. And now only recently they allowed Palestinians to fly through the Lod airport. But you know, that's very recent. And now actually with Gaza, I don't think I wouldn't even try to cross flying, you know. But anyway, at that time, so it was impossible for me even to go physically and interview them. So we decided it would be Andy, you know, the white guy from California, basically. And he played that role very well. And so Andy struggled actually to find interviewees because we found a couple of people to help us, Israelis actually from the radical group called Zahrot, or the Kirat in Arabic. And it's a Israeli-Palestinian group that calls for the decolonization of knowledge and decolonizing the Israeli mind, actually, on a Nakba or 1948. So they were the perfect partners for us. So they had a long list for us to go through, you know, to interview But then when they started contacting people, most people said no. Even to an Israeli person, they didn't want to talk. And Andy said, well, I reserved my ticket and I'm coming and I will just do our best. And eventually, you know, he was able to speak to the people you see in the documentary. Some of the people he spoke to actually didn't finish the interview. Some were interrupted by their spouses. So what you see is a very limited number of Israelis who actually agreed to speak on camera. And not all of them, as you said, there was diversity in their points of view. So some of them said, you know, it's all lies. You know, we didn't force them out. You know, about the Palestinians, they left on their own. Some said, no, I forced them out and I did this, you know, knowing that what I wanted a state without those Palestinians. And it's okay to do what I have done, like, you know, Mordechai Ben-Aur, who kills a Palestinian point blank and says, I didn't have remorse in the film. And you had those who said, I did it and I regretted and I saw my own, you know, Jewish history in what I was doing. You know, I saw the, we were doing to them what the Nazis were doing to us. And, you know, some of them even left the country. They couldn't live with that. So you have this kind of like spectrum of stories among the Israelis. And then we eventually we found out that we needed also to speak to scholars. So we started actually going after scholars. That was not easy. I tried to find the most, you know, like well-known scholars on the topic. We interviewed the most well-known scholars on the topic. There was one scholar we really badly wanted to interview, but she absolutely refused. And that's Rosemary Esper, who's a Lebanese-American who wrote Under the Cover of War. It's a great book on Nakba, but most people don't know it, which is sad because they know mostly the books written by Israeli white scholars, you know, when Palestinians, even before opening the archives in 1998, and the emergence of those scholars, like, as you said, Ilan Pape and Avi Schleim and Benny Morris. Palestinian scholars and Arab scholars had already been writing about this for ages, basically, but nobody paid attention to their books. But that's a book I highly recommend.
It seems to me that even in your story of why you couldn't travel to get the interviews, we are also talking about the Nakba. Well, the phrase Nakba has always been used to describe the horrible catastrophe for Palestinians between 1947 and 1949, when much of historic Palestine was destroyed and the modern nation state of Israel was built upon it and declared a state. Because the destruction of Palestine has never ended, the Nakba has come to mean and come to include the ongoing ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land and the ongoing destruction of Palestinian cities, towns, villages, neighborhoods, and Bedouin communities, as we saw last week. Can you talk about the ongoing Nakba?
Yes, very good point. I just want to make a quick comment on the use of modern state, because that's part of the Israeli propaganda, that they kind of modernized the region when the region was already modernized. You know, that's part of their claim. And that's important, actually. It's very related to your question, because the claim, of course, the two important myths that helped the Zionist movement colonize the land and continue to colonize it is that it was a land without people, for a people without land, that Palestine was empty, didn't have anyone or barely, you know, maybe few Bedouins, as you said. And the other myth was, you know, that they made the desert bloom. But Palestine was not a desert. Actually, Palestine was one of the most fertile countries in the world and has ancient agricultural thriving industry, actually, especially citrus, the citrus industry, the olive industry and similar, you know, ones. But it like citrus, Palestine used to actually export citrus trees, especially oranges, to Europe and the Yaffa oranges. Like there are pictures of that export, you know, and I saw some of those with Palestinians I interviewed where their families, you know, way before the state of Israel was created, used to ship citrus to Europe. Anyway, so yes, the whole, first the word Nakba in Arabic means catastrophe. And that's the word used by Palestinians to describe their 1948 experience. Now, I heard from some people, especially in the United States, you know, challenges of this word, like it's not actually very representative of the violence that came with what happened in 1948. We're talking about ethnic expulsion. I don't like the word cleansing, by the way, but that's a different conversation. Or genocide, like why would you use a word like catastrophe? Because it kind of like catastrophe is when you have natural disasters, basically, right? So a lot of people think it doesn't capture that violence. But regardless, this is how Palestinians felt, and this is how they have been expressing their experience of, you know, basically genocide that started a little bit before 1948. And in 1948, so as Israel created itself, basically, it destroyed in the process over 500 Palestinian villages, cities, and towns. And whatever was not destroyed was basically looted and basically, you know, taken over and given to Jewish immigrants from mainly Europe. Later on, of course, from Arab countries, but the majority came actually, especially at the beginning of the Zionist movement, from Europe. And about 100 cities, towns, and villages were simply given, you know, to Jews to live in those houses. And, you know, if you go, you immediately get a citizenship. You get, you know, assistance from the government. You can live anywhere you want in historic Palestine, including on the edges of Gaza, which we could talk about in a minute. And while Palestinians are never allowed to go back. Even like the internally displaced in Israel at the time, there were about 35,000 internally displaced Palestinians. What that meant, and that's because like Israel has so many discriminatory laws, now estimated at 75 laws, that clearly discriminate against Palestinians and privileges, you know, Jews. So if you were a Palestinian and you left your home to go to the market or somewhere, there's a law called the present absentee law that says you cannot go back to your home even if you didn't leave the country, right? So since then, a whole process of land theft, they call them appropriation, I call them land theft, you know, building of thousands of settlements, some of these or colonies, that's what we should call them. Some are small, some are big. The expansion of those, you know, colonies. And even when we are in this destructive war in Gaza, I mean, Israel just announced the largest land grab in its history just a few weeks ago. With no challenge from the American community.
Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to a special edition of Middle East in Focus, hosted by Esti Chandler and originating from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. It's part of Radio Free Palestine, an annual 24-hour marathon airing on Nakba Day, May 15th each year, with participation from community and progressive radio stations and producers across five continents. Host Esti Chandler's guest is professor and filmmaker Dr. Ahlam Mutaseb. We'll return to their discussion after this piece of music by the Palestinian musician Nai Barghouti. It's titled Too Soon.
كبير السما حلو وزرقا خيوط الشمس بتدفي لو بدفى هادي البحر لو عنده نبقى بس الأرض نادت علينا يمني يا ريت لو فستاني شريتي لو بتضع دروسي ساعدتي وحليتي بس الأرض نادت علينا اكتار الأولاد والبنات جنبي بعمر شهرين وشهر عندي نفس القاتل وغير الجندي وهي نادت علينا ولتبرداني وتفيت بأرضينا قتلونا بحق بس كونكم زادونا نفس العالم وصوتنا رحمونا خليتوا الأرض نادي علينا
بالأرض بالحرية ردوا تراب الأرض غالي عليهم يا ريت السماء حلوة وزرقا يا ريت الشمس بتدفي بتدفي لو أنا بدفى أخضر زيتون لو عنده نبقى بس الأرض نادت عليه.
You're listening to a special episode of Middle East in Focus for this 24-hour special on Nakba Day, produced internationally by Radio Free Palestine with the English stream produced by WPFW. Our guest is Dr. Ahlam Mutaseb, co-director and producer of the phenomenal documentary film 1948, Creation and Catastrophe. Dr. Mutaseb, you were talking about the ongoing Nakba as it lives today.
Yes. So since 1948, land appropriation, you know, kept going. It's worse than ever before. Of course, there was the occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, and Sinai Peninsula in 1967, the so-called, we call it Jun or Huzairan War. Israel brags and calls it Six-Day War because it continued its colonization of the land basically in 6 days. And so now we have the West Bank and Gaza under military occupation. And then the Golan Heights were annexed. Simply, they said, okay, this is Israeli land now, although it's actually Syrian land. Same with southern Lebanon, parts of southern Lebanon that were liberated in 2006. And similarly with also, you know, the Sinai Peninsula was returned based on the peace agreement with Egypt. So anyway, in the West Bank and Gaza, this is the place where a Palestinian independent state was supposed to happen. But I mean, Israel keeps on taking more and more land, and it has apartheid-style bypass roads for Jewish use only across the West Bank, for example, where it's impossible really to create a state. There is no room for a state anymore. And it keeps on doing this to prevent that possibility, which is, in my view, that's fine because eventually this is going to lead to the creation of a one-state solution it's inevitable. It's coming. And also, you know, if we take Gaza, I think Gaza is the prime example of this continuous genocide or Nakba, because in Gaza, we have a majority of the population, about 80 to 85% of the people in Gaza are original refugees and their descendants who were expelled from Asqalan or Ashkelon, from Bir Saba, Bir Sheva or Naqab. And in our documentary, actually, Hava Keller talks about that in a very clear way. That's why we released No Gaza in 1 minute, because she simplifies it in few sentences. She said, I arrived to Bir Sheva or Bir Saba, and, you know, the Zionists welcomed me and said, oh, you came in time. They gave me a gun and said, we are going to expel all the Arabs tomorrow. And she said, we brought like 10 to 12 buses, put all the people on buses. And I was standing there with my gun and made sure we didn't leave anyone behind and send them all to Gaza, where they are now still in Gaza. And I thought that was like one of the most, like the best summaries you can have in the film about the continuous Nakba. So you have people stranded in Gaza. It's the biggest open air prison in the world. because Israel keeps on saying, but we left, you know, we left Gaza in 2005. Yes, you left Gaza in 2005. Then you started one of the most brutal forms of siege against a community, the most densely populated area in the world, from land, sea, and air. People sometimes wonder about the tunnels, and they are so afraid of that idea. Well, you know, what do you do when you are stranded from air, sea, and land? The only thing left for you is to dig down the ground. And, you know, tunnels were a form of resistance to get, you know, all kinds of goods actually into Gaza, because the Israelis were even imposing a calorie count. You know, they put the whole population on diet, and they said very clearly that, you know, we are getting enough food just to keep the population alive and not die, but not to thrive. And that, you know, would prevent them also from resisting the siege and the occupation.
I wonder if you can discuss another part of the Nakba, the denial to Palestinians of the internationally protected legal right to return to the homelands that they were driven from or fled from, fled violence from, whether that was in 1948, in 1967, or from East Jerusalem in 2021. Is that not also part of this ongoing Nakba?
Exactly. And we have a United Nations Resolution 181, which actually kind of a legal attempt to force Israel to allow all refugees to, and it's an inalienable right to return all refugees to their homes and lands, and also compensation, right? Restitution, whatever you want to call it. But of course, Israel had always rejected that resolution, had always rejected any attempt by Palestinians to return back to their homes. The only time that Israel allowed Palestinians to return was when the Oslo peace agreement was signed in 1993. And that allowed a group segment of Palestinians to come back, to re-enter with the Palestinian Authority, the newly created apparatus. That was limited, of course. They allowed, you know, thousands of people to come back and live in the West Bank, basically, and Gaza. It allowed for thousands of Palestinians to come back. But the problem is that created basically a new apparatus called Palestinian Authority that has no authority whatsoever except participating in the repression of Palestinians in the West Bank. And before that in Gaza, but they are out of Gaza now after Hamas won the elections in 2006. So you can allow any Jewish person, ST, you can go back tomorrow and claim your Jewish heritage and get all the privileges of a citizen in Israel, though you have no connection whatsoever to the land. But anyway, any person in the world, you know, could go and claim citizenship immediately if they are Jews. But for Palestinians who had, you know, connection to the land for thousands of years, they are not allowed to go back. Many of them are still refugees in horrendous conditions, like in Lebanon, for example, in Syria. As I said, we still have refugees in Syria and Jordan. Jordan still has actually refugee camps, although they give, you know, many people citizenship, Jordanian citizenship. And of course, Gaza is, you know, the most stark example of what it means to be a refugee, prevented from your right to return to your homelands. And you have people actually basically in Gaza looking, literally being able to look at their original villages and hometowns across the border where Israeli Zionist settlers are living, taking over their land. And that's why in this country, there is no real attempt to even explain what is Ghilaf Gaza in Arabic, which means Gaza envelope. What is that? Like, people keep on saying it in the media. There is no one's discussion of that, that this was created after Israel withdrew. It's true that they actually demolished some of the settlements in Gaza and left, and then they started the siege. But they also created this kind of envelope. It's kind of like buffer zone around Gaza. And what did they do? They put settlements in there. So why would you put your citizens in harm's way? And of course, not any citizen. So usually people who live in Gaza's envelope are marginalized communities in Israel itself. So marginalized Jews themselves, especially, you know, Arab Jews. A lot of people who lived in those colonies around Gaza were either Arab Jews or African Jews or poor Jews who couldn't afford to live anywhere else except in the most dangerous area in Israel.
I wonder if we can talk about this current era of Zionist McCarthyism that we are living in, that is quite literally attempting to muzzle the nation with new legislation already passing in the House, which defines all meaningful criticism of Israel, its policies, Zionism, as anti-Semitism in order to suppress it, because supporters of Israel's policies can't win the arguments otherwise. In fact, H.R. 6408, which seeks to amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1986 to terminate tax-exempt status of terrorist-supporting organizations, is now being offered. It would permit the Secretary of the Treasury to strip U.S. groups of their nonprofit status in a preemptory manner with virtually no limitations, accountability, or meaningful recourse. As such, if enacted into law, it would provide a powerful weapon to impose mass harm on the U.S. nonprofit sector. And to be clear, while the legislation is right now being introduced and promoted as a means to target 501c3 nonprofit organizations engaged in Palestinian rights activism, if it is enacted into law, it could be used against any nonprofits working on any issue or for any objective disfavored by the administration that happens to be in power. And just over a month ago, the U.S. House joined Vienna police and the British Labour Party in seeking to punish people for using the decades-old Palestinian aspirational call for freedom from the river to the sea, Palestine mm-hmm. shall be free, by adopting a resolution condemning that phrase as anti-Semitic. Can you educate us a little bit on the history of that chant, what it means to people, and how Israeli officials say openly what they desire to exist and not exist in that land from the river to the sea, without critique, I might add?
Sure. First, you know, I just want to comment on the first part about the legislations and then say that I've never seen our Congress people so busy in their lives. Like, they cannot keep up with all these proposed legislations. And many of them come from the Jewish caucus of the Democratic Party, unfortunately. Because the Jewish caucus of the Democratic Party is, honestly, the way I see it, is another arm of the Israeli lobby in the United States. We have like a small Israel inside the United States that works very freely. No other country in the whole world can function the way that the Israeli lobby and its so many different arms and connections work as a foreign country, right? Allowed to have this space of basically changing our laws as they please, you know, day and night. And the most dangerous one is, of course, that a lot of these laws were enabled also, or these proposals were enabled, is the IRA definition, enacting it into a formal definition in the United States. And IRA stands for International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. And their definition, basically, as you said, it attempts to define anti-Semitism. And in that attempt, some of it is good, of course, because there is anti-Semitism and it's real. And it should be identified and it should be, of course, fought. But, you know, the problematic part is its equation, as you said, of any critique of the state of Israel or any anti-Zionist critique with anti-Semitism. And this has been weaponized against us over and over and over. And now, one form, as you said, of that speech, and actually I was silenced myself, you know, for using something similar. Well, I used Free Palestine, which is now also a threatening somehow. Saying Free Palestine is a threatening, you know, slogan. And somehow it's linked to, we want to enact violence against Jews. I actually had this in a former letter from my associate vice president for strategic communication. But his was actually focusing on the word genocide. that it's an incitement to violence against Jews. And I was like, because I describe what is happening in Gaza as genocide. So the slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, has different definitions to different people, honestly. For me, it's very clear. Yes, I want to liberate Palestine, all of Palestine. Now people ask me, oh, so you want to throw out the Jews and kill, you know, all the Jews and end Israel. Now, ending Israel as a Jewish-only country, absolutely. Of course, I want to end that political system. It should be dismantled. Now, how does that transform is a different question. So don't use it against me when I say it, because it's very clear for me. It doesn't necessarily mean that I want to kick out the Jews, or as they say, I want to change a political system that is based on Jewish supremacy and exclusiveness, right? And change it into something that allows freedom and equality to all of its citizens. So yes, absolutely, a new political system that is based on fairness and equity. And why is this called a bad call? It's absolutely the best call you can ever have. That's what it is. Now, for all the Jews who came to Palestine, you have Palestinians, yes, they reject that. They say, go back where you come from. I'm not going to deny that. And it's only normal, honestly, when someone comes and kick you out and kill you and kill your family and take over your house, of course you are not going to be. That's the old imagination of you have to love your colonizer. We don't have to love our colonizers. And how does that transform is, of course, different from one person to the other. I've always said, you know, we are kind and generous enough to accept the presence of our colonizers on our land, but they have to change their status from colonizers to citizens and have the same equal treatment as everyone else. So I'm a believer in a one-state solution that will be inclusive of everyone, that would allow the Palestinian refugees to come back home and get compensation. That would allow, you know, for a constitution. Israel doesn't even have a constitution, by the way. So to have a new constitution for everyone, you know. So why would a call like this be a wrong call or a genocidal call, as they now try to tell you? It's really obfuscation at best. And again, one more tool to use against people in this country who have been rising up. We have an uprising in the United States, no matter what they do. It's going on. We have intifada on especially college campuses. I know you have a question about that.
I do. And I want to also say that perhaps they're threatened by the fact that that chant tells the world that from the river to the sea is not a free place right now. But just in our last few minutes, I do want to discuss perhaps the brightest light over the last 7 months of catastrophe in Gaza. Man-made catastrophe, genocide, famine. And that has been the student uprising, the student in campuses on college and university campuses across the nation. And also it is a very dark hour for our government and our public institutions and the mainstream media as they use massive state violence in an attempt to politically cleanse an ideology that rejects our government and public institutions' support for apartheid, ethnic cleansing or displacement, as you say, inequity, injustice, and using our collective treasure, our tax dollars, for that purpose, these 76 years after the Nakba. So in our last minutes, can you talk about this repetition of history and the suppression of speech of not only those deemed the other, but also those who refuse to accept their oppression?
Yes. Well, first I want to say, if you have not been to any encampment or if you haven't been to a college campus to participate in the amazing, beautiful, unfolding student intifada or uprising in the United States, you are missing a lot. You are not being part of this historical moment. We have a South Africa moment unfolding. And it's just so amazing and so invigorating and so empowering to be part of that. Although we are not students, but just going there and supporting the students especially as faculty. Of course, I've done this on several campuses, and there is nothing that brought me more joy in my life than being part of that. And I actually like really regret not going to UCLA because I was busy with other things and I kept on postponing it. I have to go to UCLA to the encampment, and then I missed that opportunity. So make sure you don't miss an opportunity to be part of history making. And that's what gives us hope. So I'm happy that you are ending this segment with a hopeful note. No matter how much suppression and oppression and violence they have been using against those brave students, they rise up, they defy, and they also reinvent themselves in creative ways. So let me give you the example of UC San Diego, because I actually was a strong part of that. I am so proud that I actually helped the students roll down the tents, basically. So I experienced that moment, and it was so amazing. They used all kinds of violence to first take down the encampment while students were sleeping at 5 a.m., right? That's when they started, when the community was not around them to protect them. And they arrested 65 students. Actually, two of them were faculty. And they used, I was pushed and beaten. I was sprayed actually on my face with, you know, mace. And they roughed people and they pushed them when they were just peacefully protesting. We were practicing our constitutional right of freedom of expression and a protest, etc. And that's actually being slipped away from us. But anyway, so they did all of these, insisted on arresting the students. We tried to prevent the buses from leaving UCSD. They didn't. They left. They were eventually released. And what happened the next day? They erected the apartheid wall, and thousands of students yesterday and the day before walked out of classes. So there you go. You can do whatever you can. Those students are not going to be stopped. Now, this is an uprising on steroids. It's spreading like fire in hay, basically.
I can't thank you enough for your time and your lessons today. As in America, it is the foundational lies that keep social progress at bay. Without teaching our children about what the settlers did to Native Americans, how much of this country was built by slave labor, and how slavery is still at the root of inequity in America, we end up where we are today, on the brink of the failure of the American democratic experiment. And as long as Israelis and American Jews, among others, insist, in spite of so much evidence that there were no expulsions, that Palestine never existed, and that Israel was established on a land without people for a people without a land, there is no chance of peace in that land. The great irony, of course, is that historically no people have clung as stubbornly to the dream of return as have Jews. Many Jews believe that their Jewish refugee status has been passed down for 2,000 years. But at the same time, establishment Jewish and Israeli leaders and institutions denounce the fact that Palestinians passed down their identity as refugees to their children and grandchildren for these 76 years. Crimes of the past, when left unaddressed, rarely remain in the past. Once again, I want to thank our guest, Dr. Ahlam Mutaseb, Professor of Media Studies at California State University, San Bernardino, and co-producer and director with Andy Trimlett of the award-winning documentary film 1948, Creation and Catastrophe. I also want to thank Mark Maxwell for his production support today. I'm SD Chandler from Middle East in Focus on KPFK. Please stay tuned. Radio Free Palestine continues right after this break.
Tune to listener sponsored WBAI in New York. And here's Samori Marksman, supporter of human rights and the international peace movement, a much loved program director here at WBAI, reflecting on the 60s.
I'm torn by the tragedy of seeing great people pass. Kind of make me sort of wonder. I mean, it kind of make us feel that it's our turn next, you know, because a lot of people who left town are people whom we knew. I look at many people like Stokely Carmichael, of course, Kwame Ture, and having known him and so on, it's touched me, and I just, looking at something early and saw his name again, and it just kind of reminded me about that there isn't much left for those of us who were around in the 60s, you know, with people like that. People like John Henry Clark, another personal friend who, you know, took so much with him. And many of the other figures who we looked at, many entertainers and, you know, other people who made great contributions. And, you know, I'm ending with this sense of great loss, but I'm also ending in a tone of not only pondering and reflecting on these things, but being genuinely concerned.
Speaking of genuine concern, this is WBAI New York, and we're asking you to help WBAI, help keep it on the air. Support WBAI's Tower Fund. Go to towerfund.wbai.org. Keep it going. Call 212-209-2950. Support WBAI. Contribute what you can to keep this experiment, long-running experiment in free speech and alternate views and progressive commentary and programming you won't hear anywhere on the mainstream. Let's keep it alive. Let's keep it going.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
Give us a call, 212-209-2950. Support WBAI. In honor of Samori and all of the broadcasters and guests who have appeared on WBAI through the ages, preserving a platform for future speakers, for future voices to come on the air right here in the center of the FM dial at 99.5 FM to come on to WBAI, to come on to this platform and share their views and engage with you. Please help support WBAI, 212-209-2950, in honor of Samori and all the other voices you've heard here on WBAI, and all the voices that you will hear, but you don't even know who you're going to hear, but you'll hear them if you tune in to 99.5 FM in the center of the FM dial, or if you listen online, as so many of our listeners do, at WBAI.org. Please come forward and support WBAI. Become a listener member of WBAI for $25 for the year, or become a BAI buddy, a sustaining member, for 15 or more a month. And this helps WBAI know how much money is coming in, because WBAI doesn't get any corporate sponsorship. Our sponsorship is from you, our listeners, who support WBAI, who appreciate WBAI, who want to uplift WBAI and the voices that you can hear on this listener-sponsored station. Again, 212-209-2950. Please come forward right now. Let's do it for Samori. Let's do it for the other Samoris who are yet to be heard on WBAI. We thank you for your support. Please come forward now and give us a call, 212-209-2950. Thank you. Thank you so much.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice.